Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, everyone. It is Tuesday, the 18th day of November in the year 2025, and I thank you very much for joining me today for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Anglewitz, and I'll be reading the Tuesday segment of the Monitor's digital weekly edition. We will begin today with an article that comes to us from the regular Monitor column titled Global Currents. This one comes to us from Rubaya in the Congo and is submitted by Theodore de Queiroz, a contributor to the Monitor. His article is titled, Seeking Minerals, Trump Tries Deal-Making and Peacemaking in Eastern Congo. Along the ripped flanks of the Rubaya Hills in the northeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo, hundreds of workers dig through one of the world's largest concentrations of coltan, a mineral that fuels both the 21st century economy and one of its longest-running conflicts. It does not matter to them, they say, who controls these mines. It could be the Congolese government, which has struggled for decades to assert authority from a capital city some 1,600 miles away. It could be one of the militias tied to the neighboring Rwanda, which took control of this swath of Congo last year. Or it could be the United States, which this summer brokered a peace agreement between Congo and Rwanda, a first step, U.S. officials have said, to an economic agreement that could help Americans move into a minerals market long dominated by Chinese companies. In Rubaya, we dig for whomever is in charge, says a young miner named Amani, as he emerges from a dark tunnel wearing a headlamp. In this particular spot, that means Ponchelin Muntunzi, who runs one of the access points into the 7,400-acre mining site. He has been mining in the area for 15 years, and he knows the value of his leased 2,000 or so square foot plots. It's an incredibly rich place, a paradise for a farmer, says Mr. Mtunzi, who paid nearly $20,000 for his last plot, more than 540 times the monthly salary of a rural Congolese person. In 1 week, you can make your investment profitable. The whole hill is mineralized, unquote. It is a bounty that has attracted Donald Trump, who has put a priority on rebuilding American access to and processing of critical minerals. These are minerals that the U.S. Geological Survey describes as essential for national security and modern-day technology, but which currently have a vulnerable supply chain. The Trump administration has invested heavily in international mineral projects from Canada to Southeast Asia. Here he sees the potential for a double win, both as a deal maker and as a peace builder. But the realities on the ground in one of the geologically richest and most troubled regions in the world show just how complicated extending this effort to Congo may be. In 2023, Congo supplied 40% of the world's tantalum, an essential mineral found in coltan rock and used in key industries such as telecommunications, defense, and aerospace. Approximately one-fourth of this production comes from the Rubaya mines. It takes 3 hours along a narrow mud road shaped by frequent heavy rains to reach the mining site from the city of Goma, the capital of Congo's North Kivu province. In the decades since the 1994 Rwandan genocide set off a regional conflict here, hundreds of armed militias have fought over this territory. The conflict has displaced more than 7 million people, including more than 100,000 since the beginning of this year alone. Some, like the powerful Congo River Alliance, or AFC, which includes the prominent March 23rd movement rebel group M23, are connected to the Tutsi ethnic group that was murdered during the genocide and now rules Rwanda. This group seized large swaths of territory in the region in 2021, pledging to eradicate the remains of Hutu militia that took refuge in this part of Congo soon after the genocide. In April of 2024, it took the Rubaya mines. Before that, the area was held by another group called Wazalendo, or Patriots in Swahili. This was an auxiliary of the Congolese army and had a practice of pillaging Rubaya riches, according to miners there. They paid themselves by stealing bags of mineral from us, says Mr. Mtunzi. He says he's pleased by the new group in charge. The AFC M23 doesn't do that. Our prayer is that they stay in Rubaya, unquote. But even that sentiment belies the violent complications of this region. Mr. Mtunzi is Kinyarwanda speaking and shares an ethnic background with the Tutsi warlords. The U.S. Department of the Treasury has set sanctions on the militias, specifically citing their involvement in what are often called, quote, conflict minerals, unquote. Even with its unrest, Congo attracts the highest amount of mineral exploration in all of Africa, around $130.7 million in 2024, according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Much of this investment comes from China. Chinese companies have long operated in eastern Congo, and some analysts say that they have exploited the conflict and warring groups for economic advantage. Chinese firms have equity in 15 of the country's 19 copper and cobalt projects, and they control 80% of cobalt production. Two American companies also opened production in the region this year, including Cobalt Metals, which is backed by billionaires Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, and has negotiated an agreement to acquire a stake in the Manono lithium deposits south of Rubaya. But regardless of the international owners, militia groups benefit from mining here. The AFC/M23, for instance, makes no secret of profiting from the mines under its control. The mining business continues as it always has. To say that we benefit from it, to say that we benefit from it, obviously, we don't. Why don't you ask the question of if we benefit from agriculture, says Cornel Nanga, the coordinator of the movement's political branch, during a meeting this past April in his new headquarters in Goma. But that money does not only stay with the militia group, analysts say. A United Nations investigation found that ore from the Rubaya mine is regularly transported into Rwanda and enters a global smuggling network. Smugglers will often buy fake certifications for their products to launder them into quote-unquote ethical mineral supply chains, including those that end up in the U.S., according to investigators. We need to bring everyone to the table, not just the Rwandans and Congolese, but also the Burundians, Ugandans, Tanzanians, and all the stakeholders who profit from the diversion of minerals from Eastern DRC, says Zobel Bahalal, senior researcher with the Global Initiative think tank. This three decades old conflict will need more than deadlines to be solved, unquote. Analysts say that the U.S. is signaling that it will punish those involved in destabilizing the peace process in eastern Congo, which is a prerequisite for any agreement on Congolese minerals. Still, despite diplomatic pressure and the July ceasefire signed in Doha, Qatar, between Congo and the M23 under American mediation, fighting has resumed in eastern Congo. American diplomatic levers are not enough to stop the violence, says Paul Simon Handy, regional director of the Institute for Security Studies based in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Donald Trump wants to be the president who resolves conflicts without sending ground troops, unquote. There are several photographs that accompany this article, and I will do my best to describe them. The first shows women walking out of the mine with containers on their heads carrying ore. And the caption reads, "Hard labor, columbite tantalite ore, or coltan, is mined here in northeast Congo. The Rubaya mine has been under the control of the M23 rebel group since April of 2024. The second photograph shows miners climbing out of an underground tunnel that obviously leads into the mine. And the caption there is, "Underground. A digger peers up from the Rubaya mine on April 29th, 2025. He earns 10,000 Congolese francs, or about $4 per day. A third photo shows miners digging in the surface of the mine, digging up ore, obviously, and its caption is, "Collection. Miners wash coltan ore used to manufacture electronics in the Rubaya mine on April 29th, 2025. Ibrahim and Justin, in another photo adjacent, two M23 members pose for a photo in the city of Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo on February 9th. A final photo in the article shows a man pouring water or water mixed with ore over some cloth. And its caption is, "Process. A miner washes coltan from the Rubaya mine in Congo. Africa's second largest nation has supplied 40% of the world's tantalum, an element extracted from coltan." Our next article comes to us from the regular Monitor column titled The Explainer. And this article is titled, "Presidents Rarely Use the Insurrection Act. Here's how Trump might invoke it." As court battles have intensified around Donald Trump's efforts to deploy National Guard troops in U.S. cities, he's weighing another option that could allow him to significantly expand the military's domestic presence. Invoking the centuries-old Insurrection Act could give the president wider latitude to send the military into states over the objections of local officials and allow those troops to take a more active role than National Guard troops are permitted now. Trump's controversial threats to use the act, which is meant for cases of insurrection or rebellion, come as the administration encounters legal and political challenges to its efforts to involve the National Guard in a campaign against crime and illegal immigration. The president and his team appear to see the Insurrection Act as a potential way to sidestep the legal cases slowing his plans down. The administration's deployment of National Guard troops to Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Memphis, and his attempts to send service members to Chicago and Portland, Oregon, have resulted in lawsuits from most of those cities and from the states of California, Illinois, and Oregon. Multiple federal district and appellate courts have temporarily halted Mr. Trump's plans or have ruled against him, and the U.S. Supreme Court is weighing whether to respond to an emergency appeal from the Trump administration asking it to permit a deployment in Chicago. Separately, on November 7th, a federal judge in Oregon issued a permanent injunction blocking the president from deploying the National Guard in Portland. The administration is expected to appeal this decision as well. Here's a look at what the Insurrection Act says and how Trump could use it. So what is the Insurrection Act? The Insurrection Act, which was passed in 1807, allows the president to deploy the military to suppress a rebellion or enforce the rule of law in emergencies. It is the main exception to the 1878 Posse Comitatus Act, another law that normally forbids members of the military from carrying out domestic law enforcement tasks, such as arresting civilians. Presidents have generally treated the Insurrection Act as an option to be used rarely, yet some scholars worry that the law's ambiguity opens the door for greater use. The law has three sections outlining different scenarios in which the president can deploy troops. One is if a state governor requests these troops. Another is if the president determines courts are no longer functioning in a state to enforce federal law. And the third and broadest condition allows the president to deploy the military to a state if a situation there is causing some people to be deprived of their constitutional rights, and if state or local authorities are not able to enforce those rights. The president could do this even if a state's governor objects. The Insurrection Act is different from martial law, which generally means imposing military law on civilians. Troops deployed under the Insurrection Act still have to obey regular U.S. laws and can only arrest people who are breaking those laws. It doesn't give the president complete power, says Walter Olson, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. The Insurrection Act does not change what is legal and what isn't legal, unquote. However, the law does give the president considerable flexibility. Unlike some other emergency laws, the Insurrection Act doesn't come with a time limit or any requirement to consult Congress. So, when has this act been used? U.S. presidents have used the Insurrection Act 30 times, ranging from the country's early days to the late 20th century, according to an analysis by the Brennan Center for Justice. George Washington used a precursor of the act in 1792 to suppress an uprising known as the Whiskey Rebellion, and Abraham Lincoln used it when Southern states seceded from the Union at the start of the Civil War. In 1957, Dwight Eisenhower sent members of the 101st Airborne Division to protect nine black high school students from racial violence as they attended classes in Little Rock, Arkansas. The last time it was used was 1992, when California's governor asked George H.W. Bush to send troops to quell widespread riots in Los Angeles after four police officers were acquitted of beating Rodney King, an unarmed black man, during a traffic stop. Typically, when presidents have invoked the Insurrection Act, it's been a passing thing that ends quickly, says Mr. Olson. So, with that in mind, how might it be used now? Trump has repeatedly hinted at invoking the Insurrection Act. During a meeting with military leaders on September 30th, he suggested that cities could be used as, quote, training grounds, unquote, for the military. We have an Insurrection Act for a reason, Trump told reporters the following week, adding that he would enact it if people were being killed and courts, governors, or mayors were, quote, holding us up, unquote. In a Newsmax interview that same day, the president called the situation in Portland, quote, pure insurrection, unquote. Ongoing protests outside of Portland's Immigration and Customs Enforcement field office have drawn crowds of a few hundred. Law enforcement officers have fired pepper spray into the crowd, and protesters have used pepper spray and thrown rocks at agents and the building, according to court documents. Other parts of the city are largely peaceful. More recently, Trump claimed invoking the Insurrection Act would result in, quote, no more court cases, unquote, and spoke of the act while discussing San Francisco, where he has also called for deployment of the National Guard before backing off those plans. Don't forget, I can use the Insurrection Act, he told Fox News reporter Maria Bartiromo during an October 19th interview. And that's unquestioned power, unquote. Mr. Trump told Ms. Bartiromo that he prefers to deploy the National Guard for now. Unlike under the Insurrection Act provisions, National Guard members currently cannot make arrests, and they can only support law enforcement officers. Given all of that, what are the legal questions and implications? Several states have challenged Trump's deployment of the National Guard in court, with some temporary success. States might try the same tactic against the Insurrection Act, says Laura Dickinson, a professor at the George Washington University Law School. But the challenge is that for the Insurrection Act, there's language in the statute that suggests that the president has relatively broad discretion, she says, broader than the language in a section of Title 10 of the U.S. Code, the law Mr. Trump is currently invoking to deploy the National Guard. The section of the Insurrection Act that many experts say Trump is most likely to invoke would allow him to deploy troops in a state if, quote, he considers it necessary, unquote, to suppress any, quote, insurrection, domestic violence, unlawful combination, or conspiracy, unquote, that prevents the execution of laws or deprives people of their rights. The law does not define terms like insurrection, and Ms. Dickinson says this broad language leaves the president with wide latitude to decide whether these conditions are taking place and if sending in the military is, quote, necessary, unquote. This article comes to us today from staff writers Caitlin Babcock and Victoria Hoffman. Next, we turn to an article that comes to us from the regular Monitor column titled People Making a Difference. This article comes to us from Nagoya, Kobe, and Kawagoe, Japan, and is submitted by contributor Takehiko Kambayashi. The article is titled Children's Cafeterias Nourish a Sense of Community Across Japan. Fried chicken is on the menu, so the children let out a cheer. Preschoolers and primary school students are filing into Children's Cafeteria Ochan for a hot dinner in a bustling district of Nagoya in central Japan. The glass-walled cafeteria is welcoming and kid-friendly, with a spacious open kitchen and an aquarium stocked with colorful tropical fish. Meals here are well-balanced and are very, very delicious, 9-year-old Hasegawa Ichika says with a broad smile while picking up vegetables with her chopsticks. We also get fruit and dessert, unquote. Every weekday for more than 5 years, the cafeteria has provided free or low-cost home-style meals to children and other members of the community. The number of such cafeterias, also known as ibasho, or places where one feels accepted, quote-unquote, have increased exponentially nationwide during the past decade. There were 10,867 in the previous fiscal year, up from 319 in fiscal 2016, according to data cited by Musubi, a network that supports these mostly private sector initiatives. The cafeterias are run by parents and nonprofit groups, and they're staffed by armies of volunteer cooks and servers, including retirees and college students. Many cafeterias also distribute rice and produce to needy families. The ibasho surge comes as grocery prices rise in Japan and as residents struggle to cope with isolation and loneliness. Q Holdings Corporation, a local funeral service provider, operates the Ochan Cafeteria with the help of a wide array of volunteers, including a barber, a professional wrestler, violinists, and traditional tea ceremony practitioners. Food donations come from across Japan, says Fuji Yumiko, Ochan's chief chef. Thankfully, we receive corn from Hokkaido, vegetables from Takayama, and tuna from Okinawa, she notes. Supporters say you need these donations because you run the cafeteria 5 days a week. At the Mutual Support Network, a children's cafeteria in the western city of Kobe, nonagenarian Murakami Sata volunteers to teach children origami after lunch, while university students and retired teachers tutor primary students and middle schoolers. Many cafeterias have therefore been a hub for multi-generational exchange, which operators say helps children's social development. Yuasa Makoto, a prominent anti-poverty activist and the founder of Musubi, is behind the nationwide expansion of children's cafeterias. He says his group appreciates a groundswell of support from farmers and companies as they continue to donate rice despite inflation. In provincial areas, many cafeterias have never bought rice, thanks to such donations, Mr. Yuasa says. At Misora Children's Cafeteria in Kobe, dozens of children and some parents have hot meals in an 880-square-foot straw-matted room twice a month. Nakayama Yu says her preschool-age daughter, Yuri, has a pretty good appetite when eating with many others here. Yuri also likes the cross-cultural events organized by university student volunteers. Asahi Kazuyo launched the cafeteria in 2019 to help ease the burden on working parents and keep children from eating alone. Ms. Asahi says some of the mothers who came to the cafeteria confided to her a number of complex problems, including their children's school absenteeism. So she has invited experts to Misora to speak to mothers, educators, and care workers. Japan's government set up an office to address loneliness and isolation in 2021 as these issues worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic. The number of children who died by suicide hit a record high of 529 in 2024, the worst among the group of seven industrialized countries, according to Japan's Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare. Overall suicide figures, however, have declined. Japanese mothers who shoulder the lion's share of raising children tend to be isolated as more people get less involved with communities and even their relatives, says Yoneda Sachiko, a consultant with the Children's Future Support Office in Yokohama. Ms. Yoneda, who also teaches at Kanto Gakuin University, recalls she had a feeling of stagnation while raising her own children. "So did children in my community, which drove me to act," she says. Koike Maname, the head of a nonprofit in Kawagoe, north of Tokyo, first established a children's cafeteria in May of 2023. Now she runs three sites and also organizes games and plays for child-rearing families. "It takes a community to raise a child," Ms. Koike says. "I would like every member of a community to give lots of love to children," unquote. Mr. Yuasa says children's cafeterias have also helped rebuild communities as they create opportunities for locals to interact with one another. Gidu Kazuyoshi agrees. He leads the nonprofit group Hinitaboko in the town of Shiranuka on Hokkaido, about 550 miles northeast of Tokyo. Like many other rural areas in Japan, Shiranuka faces an aging society and depopulation. Mr. Guido started a children's cafeteria in 2019 after severe illness kept him from work for 11 years. "During my recuperation, I made up my mind to do something for others," the octogenarian recalls. "Social connections are absolutely necessary for these children," unquote. Every Sunday, volunteers in their 70s and 80s cook lunch for children and older residents, while the group distributes bento boxes to more than 130 single-parent households three times a month. Other residents also volunteer to tutor children, he says. Back at Ochan, Ms. Fujie, a flamenco dancer who has two grown daughters, wants the cafeteria's work to have lasting effects. "My hope is that when these children grow up and remember this place," she says, "they will decide to give something back to their communities." Very often with articles in the Monitor, there is a brief statement of why we wrote this. And for this article, why we wrote this is: the number of children's cafeterias in Japan has surged in the past decade, as grocery prices rise and residents cope with loneliness and isolation. There are also two photographs accompanying the article. The first of one is a photograph of Chef Fujie Yumiko in her kitchen. And it says that Chef Yumiko says donations to the children's cafeteria Ochan in Nagoya come from all across Japan. The second photograph, which is really cute, is a photograph of a mother and daughter eating at the cafeteria. Daughter looks to be about maybe 6 years old. And the caption reads, "A meal with meaning." Nakayama Yu left, that's the mother, says her daughter Yuri has a good appetite when she comes to Misora Children's Cafeteria in Kobe. Yuri also likes events organized by the volunteers. Now let's return to the United States, and specifically to Washington, D.C., and, as usual, politics, for an article titled House to Vote as Trump Struggles to Defuse Epstein Issue. This article is submitted to us by Cameron Joseph and Story Hinckley, both staff writers for the Monitor. The House is expected to pass a bill on Tuesday, that's today, to require the Trump administration to release all files related to convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a milestone moment for an issue that just won't go away for Donald Trump. After fighting the bill's passage for months and facing certain defeat, the president threw his support behind it at the last minute on Sunday. "We have nothing to hide, and it's time to move on," he declared. Trump's 11th-hour support for the bill helps mask House Republicans' first major rebuke of the president since he returned to office in January. Dozens were expected to break with the White House and vote for the bill to address public demand for information about Mr. Epstein's ties with elite Americans, including Mr. Trump. Mr. Epstein died in prison in August of 2019. And it comes amid a rough few weeks for the president. Declining poll numbers, economic headwinds, and rough recent elections for the GOP have sent him seeking a reset on bread-and-butter issues, messaging that he has repeatedly groused the Epstein issue is distracting from. "Let the Senate look at it. Let anybody look at it. But don't talk about it too much," he said on Monday at the White House, claiming that, quote, "the whole thing is a hoax," unquote, meant to distract from his economic accomplishments. "All I do care about is that Republicans get back on point, which is the economy," he posted on Truth Social on Sunday evening. Trump could easily order the release of the files himself. His steadfast refusal to do that, after repeatedly promising to do so during his 2024 presidential campaign, has led to a nagging problem with voters across party lines. That includes a significant subset of his Make America Great Again supporters who have long obsessed over Mr. Epstein's crimes and believe they are part of a much vaster conspiracy. More than three-quarters of Americans, including two-thirds of Republicans, want all the files released to Mr. Epstein related to Mr. Epstein released, according to a PBS News NPR Marist poll released in October. The issue has clearly animated a portion of the MAGA base, which for the first time is at odds with their movement's leader. Republican strategist Doug Hay says that deep concern over the matter, quote, "has always been there in the core of the Trump base," unquote, "and won't go away." Mr. Hay cites on-the-ground evidence of this with Trump's hardline supporters. Last summer, the strategist was in Lake Ozark, Missouri, a deep red rural vacation spot, and popped into a store called Teresa's Trump Shop. He asked the woman working that day about releasing the Epstein files. Her response, "What's the holdup?" The issue has put Mr. Trump at odds with a large swath of his supporters ever since the Justice Department released a two-page memo on July 7 stating that, quote, "no client list," unquote, exists, and the president urged his backers to move on. Shortly thereafter, Democratic Representative Ro Khanna of California and Republican Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky teamed up to organize a discharge petition in an effort to go around Republican Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana. With 218 votes, a simple majority of the House, the bipartisan duo could force a vote on the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which would require the Justice Department to, quote, "publish in a searchable and downloadable format all unclassified records, documents, communications, and investigative materials in DOJ's possession that relate to the investigation and prosecution of Jeffrey Epstein," unquote. The bill has received powerful support from many of Mr. Epstein's victims. Mr. Massie, as well as the other three Republicans who voted with all 214 Democrats in favor of the petition, Representatives Nancy Mace of South Carolina, Lauren Boebert of Colorado, and Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, have all faced sharp criticism from the White House. Trump is backing a primary challenger against Mr. Massie, and on Friday, the president posted on Truth Social that he was withdrawing his endorsement from, quote, "wacky Marjorie," an erstwhile close ally who has recently opposed the president on several issues. Administration officials, including Attorney General Pam Bondi, met with Ms. Boebert in the Situation Room last week in an effort to persuade her to withdraw her support for the discharge petition. Ms. Mace, who is currently running for governor in South Carolina, also reportedly faced pressure to remove her name from the petition. When appearing on ABC News this week on Sunday, Mr. Massie said Tuesday's vote could have a, quote, "deluge of Republicans voting in favor, potentially, quote, 100 or more," unquote. Mr. Trump's about-face and last-minute support is a relief for many House Republicans. "Last week it was concerning because there would have been a lot of divisions," says a House GOP operative who asked for anonymity to be able to speak candidly. Trump trying to open this up and saying, "I support the release," is a smart move. We're expecting a large number of members to vote in support. The White House probably read the writing on the wall and saw that this was going to pass, unquote. The issue tied House Republicans in knots for months, grinding the lower chamber to a halt. Speaker Johnson sent lawmakers home for more than 2 months, including the entirety of the government shutdown, and refused to swear in Democratic Representative Adelita Grijalva after she won a special election in September. Ms. Grijalva was the 218th signature to put the discharge petition over the finish line and force a divisive vote on the Epstein issue. So what role is there for the Senate? While Trump's pivot obscures the number of House Republicans who were ready to break with him over the issue, it could prod Senate Republicans to act, keeping the issue in the news. Senate Majority Leader John Thune has repeatedly declined to promise any action on the bill, but Mr. Trump's decision to stop publicly fighting it may change that calculus. Trump jumped on a train that's already left the station in the House in an attempt to show that there's nothing there, said former Senate Republican leadership aide Ron Bongean. If there are 400 or more votes in the House for this, then the Senate will feel more pressure to act, unquote. This vote comes at a recent low point for the president. Mr. Trump's approval rating is the lowest it's been in his second term. 55% of voters disapprove of the job he's doing, with just 41% approving, according to Nate Silver's polling average. Republicans just suffered a drubbing in this November's elections, where they faced double-digit blowout losses in contests from New Jersey and Virginia to Georgia, Pennsylvania, and California. The 2026 midterm elections are now less than a year away, worrying Republicans in swing districts and states. That's been largely driven not by the Epstein files, but by economic concerns. Voters are identifying the cost of living as the top issue, and they give Trump low marks on the subject. The president is showing signs that he knows he needs a course correction on that front. He reversed himself and repealed a number of tariffs on grocery staples over the weekend, and he has sought to refocus his rhetoric on kitchen table issues in recent days. It's unclear whether this reset will work. His predecessor, Joe Biden, attempted a similar rhetorical focus on driving costs down, even billing his core legislative accomplishment the, quote, Inflation Reduction Act, unquote. Still, voters booted his party from the White House in 2024, largely because of voter dissatisfaction over cost of living issues. If Trump wanted to release the Epstein files and end the fight, he could do that at any point. His decision to battle their release for months has only further fueled speculation as to why and raised questions about what he may not want the public to see. The vote comes after the House Oversight Committee, which is conducting its own investigation into Mr. Epstein, released more than 20,000 documents on Wednesday that it had obtained from Mr. Epstein's estate. Trump is mentioned almost 1,000 times in the documents, along with other prominent men, such as former President Bill Clinton and former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers. In one 2019 email, Mr. Epstein wrote that Mr. Trump, quote, knew about the girls, unquote. Mr. Trump and Mr. Epstein were friends from the 1980s through at least the 2000s. Mr. Epstein is, quote, a terrific guy, unquote, the president told New York Magazine in 2002, adding that, quote, he's a lot of fun to be with. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side, unquote. There are photos and video footage that show Mr. Trump socializing with Mr. Epstein and his former partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, who was sentenced to prison in 2022 for assisting Mr. Epstein's abuse of young women. Trump said in 2019 that the two had a, quote, falling out, unquote, over a decade earlier, after they competed for a piece of real estate in Palm Beach, and Mr. Epstein reportedly hired spa attendants away from the president's Palm Beach club, Mar-a-Lago. After Mr. Epstein was arrested on sex trafficking charges in 2019, Mr. Trump said he was, quote, not a fan of his, unquote. For this article, Cameron Joseph reported from Washington and Story Hinckley reported from Richmond, Virginia. Let's conclude our reading today with a book review. And this book review comes to us from contributor Heller McAlpin. The article is titled, A Love of Reading Fuels a Working Man's Desire for a Better Life. I might have missed English writer Benjamin Wood's quiet fifth novel, titled Sea Scraper, had it not reached the long list for this year's prestigious Booker Prize. That would have been a pity, because it's a gorgeous, atmospheric tale about a 20-year-old shrimp harvester who yearns for more out of life. Set in a fictional coastal town in northwest England called Longferry, a stand-in for the author's hometown of Southport, Sea Scraper immerses us in the life of Thomas Flett during what turns out to be an unusually exciting, pivotal day for him. The story feels timeless, though it's set in the early 1960s. We meet Tom on a damp morning that begins like every other since he was forced to leave school at age 13 to work alongside his grandfather. Rising well before sunrise, he tends to his horse, bolts the bacon and eggs his mother fries up for him, and heads out in his horse cart under a foggy pre-dawn drizzle to scrape the shore at low tide for shrimp. He lets his thoughts wander balefully, even as he keeps a watchful eye for deadly sinkholes in the rippled sand. Tom was raised by his cantankerous late grandfather, who assuaged his disappointments with drink, and by his single mother, Lillian Flett, whom we see through Tom's critical eyes. Both mother and son are grateful that Pop let her keep the boy, despite the enduring disgrace of her pregnancy at age 15. Although Tom knows that, quote, one day soon there'll hardly be a morsel left for him to scrounge up from the beach that can't be got by quicker means at half the price, unquote. Shrimping further down the coast with motor rigs, he's the only shanker left in town who's steadfast to the old ways, unquote. We trudge along with Tom through the 30-hour span of the novel. We feel his frustration at his monotonous, barely sustainable life. It bores him worse than it exhausts him, Wood writes. It never used to foul his mood this much, the cold, the loneliness, the graft, but that was long before he harbored any aspirations for himself besides what he was raised to want, unquote. Why the change? Tom was a good student who left school with, quote, an awareness of his own capacity, unquote. He remains an avid reader, and these past few years he's come to understand he settled for too little. Tom feels most alive when playing folk music on the beat-up guitar for which he traded his grandfather's watch. It's an activity he feels he must hide from his mother, who worries about making ends meet. Sea Scraper effectively combines two common literary tropes, a day in the life and a stranger comes to town. The stranger is a fast-talking American named Edgar Acheson, who claims to be a Hollywood movie director. Like Harold Hill in The Music Man, Acheson talks big. He's eager to film an old novel called The Outermost, and he hopes Henry Fonda will play the lead, one of several tip-offs that Sea Scraper is set decades ago. He promises to put Longferry on the map. I love the bleakness of this place. I've never seen a beach so uninviting, he raves. Tom, at first skeptical, is entranced. You could knock on every door in Longferry and never find a man as interesting, he thinks. Acheson hires Tom to bring him to the beach at dusk during the second low tide of the day so he can take some scouting shots. They're soon dangerously engulfed by dense fog. Acheson's check, paid in advance, is a big windfall for Tom, but whether or not the man turns out to be what he says he is, Tom is grateful for his life lessons. Acheson tells him, quote, "When you're young, you think life is a string of choices. You don't realize that most of it, of what'll happen to you is because of other people's choices. Art's the only way I've ever had of making any sense of it," unquote. I'll let readers discover where this is going, but I can say that Sea Scrapers, Revelations, and Epiphanies are well earned and surprisingly moving. Wood's novel is a lovely moral tale that recognizes the importance of reconciling practical concerns and necessities with spiritual, emotional ones. It is also about the power of art, music in particular, to uplift and inspire. And it comes with a link to a recording of Thomas Flett's Cartshanker's Gospel, a song called Sea Scraper. Again, the book is titled Sea Scraper. It is written by British novelist Benjamin Wood. And that brings us to a conclusion of our reading today. I thank you very much for joining me for readings from the Christian Science Monitor. My name is Tom Anglewitz. As always, I wish you a most pleasant, safe, and healthy day. And we invite you to stay tuned for our next regularly scheduled program.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.